Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Katie Britton. What most people know about Emily Dickinson's life is this. She was a poet, reclusive, wore white, and came from a well-to-do family. But one fact that may surprise you is that she loved to bake. She would make cakes and have them delivered to people in town, and lower gingerbread in a basket to the waiting children below her window. It's this premise that helped novelist Nuala O'Connor write Miss Emily.
It was a combination of things, really. I studied Emily's poetry at school, as I'm sure every American teenager does also, and really fell in love with her poetry, kind of suited my personality, sort of melancholic, you know, and inward-looking, probably as Emily was also to a certain extent. And then later in life, I heard that she loved to bake, and I loved to bake. So I began to cook her recipes for different cakes, coconut cake, gingerbread, a black cake that she used to make, very large fruit cake. And while I was doing that, I wrote a poem about Emily as baker, that, you know, the thing that she used to share gingerbread with children by lowering a basket from her window. And I wrote a poem about that. And I was musing about the fact that, you know, wouldn't it have been great if she had had Irish maids? And then I found out by researching that she had had Irish maids. And suddenly the germ for a novel was sown. And so I began to sort of search around for a good time in Emily's life to begin a narrative. And I hit on the year 1866, where she really had begun her retreat from being outdoors in earnest. It was also around the time that she turned to wearing just white clothing. So these were a couple of moments of quiet drama, and I slotted my maid in there. Now, I didn't use any of her real maids. I decided to make it easier on myself because I was dealing with one person's history, Emily's. It was easier for me to invent a new Irish maid and slot her into that time space where, in fact, the Dickinsons didn't have a maid. So that's what I did.
Having that freedom to create a new character, Ada Concannon, and to be able to slip her into their lives, it must have given you such a wonderful freedom to go into the Dickinsons' lives as well as Ada's.
Exactly. As I said, they didn't have a maid that year, so people are probably aware that one of their longest-standing maids was an Irish woman called Maggie Marr. So while I invented Ada completely, she's a complete fabrication, I made her a cousin of Maggie's. So I could use some of Maggie's family history to make a history for Ada. And then for her to bring her, she was very young when she joined their household, she was 17. So for her to bring her youth and her freshness, she's an energetic kind of a girl. She loves to talk. She's a little bit superstitious. So to slot her into the house then with Emily, her sister Vinnie, and their parents. So she comes in and makes a few little ripples, you know, because Mrs. Dickinson complains that Ada likes to talk a lot, but this is actually what Emily loves about her. So they swap stories in the kitchen. Emily loved to bake, and over making things like quince jam and black cake, they bond and form a really firm friendship.
I found those were the scenes that I gravitated towards because you were waiting to see what they would talk about, what Emily would open up to Ada about, or just the little lines of poetry that you would work into the novel, which that in itself, you wove her poems beautifully within the novel. Was it hard for you to try to find a spot, or would it just come naturally?
I suppose I would try and use something that was appropriate for the for whatever they were talking about or that suited the mood of the piece. You know, I read a lot of research books about Emily, and obviously I read her poetry again and again in the course of writing the novel. I tend to research as I write, so the two things go hand in hand. And certain poems we would have learned at school, like Because I Could Not Stop for Death, and those kind of ones that maybe are the standard ones that everybody learns. But of course, there are 1,800 or so Emily poems. And so I was reading poems that I really had never read before and trying to understand them and, you know, finding where maybe I could put them in. I think in the end, I only quoted 6 poems in the book. But what I did do was, Emily was a prolific letter writer. Obviously, she didn't go out and see people much, so she wrote to people, and her letters are very vivacious and very interesting. So I read her letters, and from that, I tried to create a voice for Emily that was similar to her real voice, but maybe slightly toned down for the sake of the reader. And so using maybe the basis of the way she wrote or spoke, if you want to think of it like that, I invented a different, a new language for Emily. And that was kind of challenging, but enormous fun as well. Really an interesting thing to write a whole new language for someone who is essentially an American icon.
It seems like such a massive task. I don't know if I would be able to tackle it, which is why somebody like you, who is an amazing author, would be able to bring that to life.
It was terrifying, though. I mean, it feels audacious. I'm Irish. I live in Ireland. I guess the challenge for me was trying not to make Emily sound Irish, to try and make her sound American, to try and make her sound Victorian, to try and make her sound as loquacious and clever as she was, without alienating the reader in a sense, because Emily loved to riddle and she loved in-jokes. And so sometimes when you read her letters, you're not really in on the joke and you kind of have to struggle to understand what she's talking about. Ditto with some of her poetry. It's not always 100% clear what she is trying to get at, but that's the challenge. I mean, I did tiptoe around writing this book. I got the idea and I sort of inched towards it and inched away and did that a few times until finally I just said, oh, for goodness sake, just sit down and do it. You know, the worst that can happen is that you fail. And I mean, I think as well, no matter what you write, at the end, when it's done, you still cannot be objective about it or know if it has succeeded or not. I was very heartened by my agent's reaction to it. She really was so positive about it that I kind of thought, oh, well, maybe people will like it, you know, that kind of way.
It's beautifully written. And you were speaking about her letters, and we do get a touch of it when she's writing to her best friend, Sue, who also happens to be her sister-in-law. And I didn't know much about Emily Dickinson until I read this novel, and then I started researching, trying to figure out what was real and what wasn't real. But, I mean, they were so close to each other, and then there were nuances on whether or not it was something a little bit more, their feelings for each other were a little bit more. You don't tiptoe around it, but I feel that you do it justice, their relationship with each other and their friendship.
Good. I mean, I don't answer the question, was Emily in love with Sue? I do believe she loved her ardently. I mean, she hoped that they would be buried together. That's quite a large thing to say about your friend, you know. But Victorian women friendships were very, very intense. They weren't really the way we conduct friendships today. We have a lot of distance between, physical distance sometimes, but also, like, if, say, Emily's friend was coming to stay, they would share a bed. There would be no question about that. Not to say that anything happened, but that was that physical closeness. They would touch each other a lot. You know, they would talk about their deepest, darkest things with their friends. And Sue was very intellectual. She was very social. So in a way, she was an opposite to Emily that Emily probably really admired. But she also was a great editor for Emily. Emily bounced a lot of her work off Sue. And she just loved her. I would say that as a friend, Emily was possibly quite an intense, demanding type of friend. You know, maybe even more so than people would welcome. But Sue recognized her genius. She was one of the few people who recognized Emily's writing genius in her lifetime.
You talk about the friendship, but I mean, back then, women depended on their friendships with other women so much more than they do today.
Yeah, I think a lot of us make little island nations of ourselves within possibly our marriages, you know, so with our husband or with our wife, women, I mean, and that friendships are conducted at a distance that we don't see people as often maybe as they used to then. Like, for example, a friend who would come to stay with Emily might stay for a few weeks. That's not really the way we conduct our friendships anymore. There isn't that huge, close intensity, but I guess, you know, we have the advantage of telephone, email, all of that she didn't have.
Emily, in this reclusive phase, and she's beginning to be, and you give us a very good glimpse at that panic that overtakes her when she has to venture out into the outside world. But we get to see her live vicariously through Ada because she watches her from the window and she watches everybody through her windows.
Yes, and she absolutely did do that. She has there is a cupola on top of her house, the homestead in Amherst, and she would go up there to observe what was going on. It's not that she wasn't interested in people. It's that I think crowds and, you know, the noise and the chatter that that entails just wasn't for her, you know. And also there is the business of when you are an artist, you need time alone. You know, if you're trying to create, you need no distraction. So it has to be between you and the page or you and the brush if you're an artist, a visual artist. So she recognized that she needed a lot of time alone to write. She was a maverick, you know. She was single-minded. The family in its entirety was quite eccentric. They were very well-to-do. They were people of note in Amherst, one of the top families in the town. Her father brought the railroad to Amherst. Her grandfather founded Amherst Academy. And, you know, so they had a lot of sway in the town, but the children were quite, Emily, her brother and sister were quite, they beat their own path, shall we say.
And on the flip side, Ada, when she's in Ireland, she knows she's destined for bigger and better things. And when she gets on that ship, she just turns around and faces her new destiny. And instead of feeling bad that I'm leaving Ireland now. And I think by becoming friends with Emily, Emily brings something more to Ada and lets her know that, yes, you can teach people things and that you don't have to stay silent and just stand there and cook and clean for us.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in a sense, the book is about cross-generational friendship. There's 18 years between the two women, between Ada and Emily. So Ada learns a lot from Emily, you know, because Emily was a very wise and, you know, she was a thinker. She thought about things. So Ada learns a lot from that because Ada would be more inclined to be frivolous and do things. Well, she's young, you know, and I know a young person at that time was actually a lot older than they are now. They had to have a certain level of maturity. They were usually working from the age of whatever, 10 or 11 in Ireland anyway. So they learn from each other. And that's the beauty of it. I wanted to explore female friendship. A lot of my previous work, novels and short stories, have been about the mother-child relationship. So it kind of did me good to get away from that for a while, even though it's slightly explored with both Emily and her mother and Ada and her mother. I wanted to show female friendship in its glory.
Well, you did that very well. And Nuala will be in South Hadley, Massachusetts at the Odyssey Bookstore at 7 p.m. on August 5th. And we look forward to seeing you. Nuala, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks a million, Katie. Pleasure.
Again, the name of Nuala O'Connor's novel is Miss Emily. It is published by Penguin. And O'Connor will be at Odyssey Bookstore in South Hadley, Massachusetts next Wednesday at 7 p.m. For more information about her appearance and links to Emily Dickinson's recipes, visit our website, wamc.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.